welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. Today on Addressing Alaskans, Mayor Dan Sullivan's State of the City Address, plus an update on Title 21, Anchorage's Land Use Code, from former Anchorage Assembly member Dan Coffey. Hosted by Building Owners and Managers Association of Anchorage, also known as BOMA, on Friday, June 10th, a special edition of Addressing Alaskans with Mayor Dan Sullivan and Dan Coffey is coming up next on KSKA after the news. This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan's State of the City Address, hosted by the Building Owners and Managers Association at the Anchorage Hilton. It was recorded live on Friday, June 10th.
Welcome, everybody, to the June 2011 BOMA. I'm Andrew Rummerdahl, your president. And right now, I'm going to bring up our two featured guest speakers, and I've been at their request, I'm not going to go through the lifelong bio. I'm going to keep it short and sweet. Everyone probably has heard both of these guys speak. They're both lifelong Alaskans. They're both longtime servants, for a better lack of the word, to our community and to our city, and we're very lucky to have them working hard for us. So first, I'd like to bring up Mayor Dan Sullivan to give us the state of the city, and then after he's done, I'm going to bring up Dan Coffey to give a little Title 21 update. So please welcome Mayor Dan Sullivan.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. As always, when I wake up, the first thing I say is it a great day to be in Anchorage, Alaska. On a summer day like today, it's particularly true, and particularly true for me today to be able to get out of the office and speak with folks who actually make things happen in our city, and that's always a privilege for me. It's been a very interesting week. We truly are an international city this week. We had the, you may have seen the Japanese Naval Defense Force ships in town. I had the opportunity to visit the ship, visit the Rear Admiral, who's the highest ranking member of the Japanese Defense Forces. And this guy was educated at Johns Hopkins, spoke perfect English, and on his shore time, while all of his sailors were out perusing the shops, he climbed flat tops. So this guy, I guess when you're at sea for 120 days, that's probably, you want to get as much land as you can get. And then we were privileged, of course, we had the British ambassador, Sir Scheinwald, in town. And he's here for 8 days, just on his own for a visit, and he always wanted us to see Alaska. And he's going to be followed in about 10 days, totally unrelated, but 70 ambassadors to the United States from 70 different countries are coming to Alaska. They have a program called Experience America, and they voted on where to go, and they wanted to come here. So we'll be graced with their presence here in about 10 days, and so certainly folks in the retail business, I think, are going to see a nice little surge, because I think these guys make pretty good money, and they'll probably spend it here, so we're happy about that. Well, we're going to talk a little bit today, at least my portion of the discussion is going to be really just on the last quarter or so of our city, what's been going on, give you some updates and some highlights, and then I will turn it over to Dan Coffey, and he will update you on Title 21, which I think probably everybody in this room has some interest in, and kind of let you know how the process is going and what we can anticipate going forward. I think you can probably see the screen pretty good. We're going to talk about crime, how we did with the legislature, our efforts on homelessness and panhandling, kind of a summary of what happened in April, and then a new initiative I'm starting, the Mayor's Education Summit. First responsibility, as you know, of any government is to protect its citizens, and so we take public safety very, very seriously, and we're real pleased to report that in 2010, we saw a reversal of a several-year trend in terms of crime, particularly violent crime. For 5 or 6 years, we had seen violent crime on the rise in Anchorage, and we're starting to see those numbers go the right direction. As you can see, murder down 7%, forcible rape down 6.4%, robbery down 15%, and of the four violent crime statistics, there was one uptick in aggravated assault. So three out of the four statistics and overall crime are down, so we're pleased about that. One of the things that we focused on when we first came into office is we wanted to make sure that we were deploying our public safety resources, which are extremely valuable resources, obviously, in the most efficient manner possible. So we did what we called the PERF report, and you see this is the Police Executives Research Forum. They came and looked at our department and made suggestions on how to reorganize to get the maximum effectiveness, and we're starting to implement some of those changes. What we're trying to do, of course, is focus more on street-level crimes. There had been the trend in the previous years to focus maybe on trying to get to the kingpin drug lords, which is time-consuming and oftentimes not successful. But if you focus on the street-level crimes, you're typically getting people that are committing multiple crimes, and you can actually solve a number of crimes with every arrest when you're dealing with that street-level activity. And it's also the crime that people see in their neighborhoods. You get calls all the time that there's a lot of suspicious activity at this house across the street. And so again, our department is really focused on that level. And then the other thing we're of course trying to implement is more true community policing, which is you assign your police officers to a specific beat. They get to know the neighborhoods, they get to know the businesses, they get to know the bad characters, and they build up a trust relationship so people are more willing to share information with them. And we are trying to build up the resource in the department, adding personnel. We have an academy coming this fall, and it takes personnel to do true community policing, but there's some things you can start right away, which we have, which is assigning beats and making people responsible for a particular area. So that's moving along pretty good, and we are starting to see, like I say, some pretty good results from that, so we're pleased about that. We just, of course, as you know, finished up the legislative session with a special session thrown in for good measure, and we put together a booklet of our priorities every year that we give to our legislators, and you never get it all funded, but you do try and get some of your top priorities. We'd actually asked for $20 million for the port expansion, and we ended up getting $37.5 million, so that was a good success. And I'll give you a little update on the port, because it's been controversial, and rightfully so. This is a project that I think is sometimes mischaracterized as the port's project. And in fact, it's a federal government project, MARAD. The Maritime Administration is the agency responsible for the port reconstruction. And the port's job in the meantime is essentially to run the port. So I know Governor Sheffield has gotten some criticism about not handling this construction project, but quite frankly, he's not in charge of the construction project. He's in charge of operating the port while the construction project is going on around him. And his job, of course, is to try and minimize any conflicts between the construction and the activity of the port, which, as we all know, is the lifeblood for Alaska. It's our lifeline. 80% of all the goods entering the state come in through that port, and so it's obviously of vital interest to the entire state. So several things happened when we came into office. It was reported to us literally within weeks that the construction at the port was not going properly, that the installation of the sheet piles had been mismanaged, that there's a lot of damage in those sheet piles. So for the last 2 years, instead of moving forward on port construction, we've actually been going backwards, tearing up sheet piles, removing them, remediating, reinstalling piles where possible, and taking a look at the overall project and determining whether or not we can really meet what the design requires. And it's a challenge. And because of the delays, we're now to the point where a $350 million project is now priced at about $1 billion. Well, as you can imagine, that creates a little sticker shock for your funders, whether it's the state legislature or the federal government agencies, DOT and others that have been contributing money to the project. So what we've done is we've actually done about five things to try and get this thing back on the tracks. First and foremost, we looked at the agreement between the city, the port, and MARAD, and found it to be extremely deficient. There was no indemnity for the port, there was no liability insurance, no bonding from the contractors or subcontractors to indemnify the port in case any activity was disrupted. And so we changed that. The new agreement is going to make sure that the city is properly insured and indemnified for any mistakes done in construction. We've also formed an oversight committee to look at the port and make sure that there's timelines, benchmarks, and quality control, which is another thing that was lacking in the original agreement, was there was a real lack of quality assurance throughout the process. We've got a full-time MARAD person here now, where before, they occasionally would be here. And, you got a multi-$100 million project, you can't just occasionally be here. It's not the way to manage a project like that. In fact, our friends from MARAD probably were not the right agency to manage this project in the first place. It should have been the Corps of Engineers or maybe the DOT or somebody, but MARAD had never managed a project of this size and scope before. So, and then we also have a forensic audit happening where we're looking at the damage that was done, who's responsible, because right now there's an awful lot of finger pointing going on about you know, who is responsible for what. And so, as you can imagine, there's litigation, and it's going to be probably a while before all that gets sorted out. But meanwhile, we've got to get this project back rolling again, because you can't have a half-finished port expansion. It just will not work. So we think we're back on track. We've actually got a meeting coming up with all the port users, particularly Toad and Horizon. I've asked the port to produce a scaled-down plan of the expansion, something that'll get us to where we can satisfy our main shippers, and maybe the other phases are pushed back, because, quite frankly, we're seeing very, very high challenges in getting another $900 million for this project. You know, it's not rolling off the tongue of legislators very easily right now. But we do think there's a possibility of a port bond for port projects all over the state in the next year or two, and in that we could probably get sufficient funding to finish at least the scaled down projects. So we're hoping that the governor keeps us at the $37.5 million. That'll allow us to keep moving forward on the port project. We've spoken with the governor and Governor Parnell, and it looks like I think he believes in the port project, and so hopefully that stays in. The other item that we're working on that was one of our priorities is our Project 80's renewal. And the legislature did fund us to about a little over almost $10 million. And this is the Lusac Library, the Sullivan Arena, the Egan Center, the Performing Arts Center, really all those facilities that are now closing in on 30 years of age and need major renewal so the next generation can enjoy them like we've enjoyed them for the last several decades. And it's real important to the quality of life in Anchorage that we keep these facilities upgraded. So we're hopefully that'll stand as well, and we've conveyed that to the governor that we'd like to really get those facilities. And he's a big believer in deferred maintenance as well, and I think this resonates with him as a project. We did very well in the initial go-around with roads and parks. We've got literally many tens of millions of dollars in money for roads and parks in Anchorage. And the Parks Foundation has been very helpful. And they get matching money for money that we get from the state legislature. And they like that when you can leverage money that they give you. So we're confident or hopeful anyway that we'll keep a lot of our roads and parks monies. And then there's always requests to the legislature for outside agencies that don't really come through the municipality, but generally that we support, like the Blood Bank, Covenant House, and I think we're all familiar with the flat top parking lot issue because it's gotten a lot of publicity lately. But there is a need up there. Last summer, our poor police department doing their job, of course, you know, when you park along the road there on both sides of the road, you cannot get an emergency vehicle into the homes that inhabit up there, and so a lot of tickets were written, and they're expensive tickets, and we don't want to keep doing that. So I think you've got an asset like Flat Top, and that whole entrance to the park is so valuable that we need more parking, quite frankly. And so hopefully, again, that might stay in too. We'll see. And that's just really not just the kind of the start of the needs. That won't even take care of all the need, but at least be a good start. The other thing that we were successful on, we always have legislative things in addition to our capital requests, and we're very pleased that we were able to get the Davis-Bacon Law changed, which is not an easy thing because that is entrenched almost in stone, you know, with the unions, you know, fought many years to make sure that prevailing wages are used on government projects. And the way the law was written is any project over $5,000, you had to pay Davis-Bacon wages. And we've gotten that changed to $20,000. So we wanted 50, but as in all politics, you know, there's compromise, and 20 is better than 5. And so it means on our small projects that we do around town where, maybe a nonprofit wants to take on a task force, they're not required, or we're not required if we contract with someone under $20,000 to pay Davis-Bacon wages. So we're pleased about that. The other bill that passed that we promoted, we actually started it here in Anchorage, is the SPICE bill, which I think you've probably, again, heard a lot about. It's the synthetic marijuana that's being distributed as SPICE or K2 and essentially being sold as incense, or there's even a new product out now that's supposedly sold as bath salts. It's a synthetic meth or something, or cocaine, yeah. And so there's a very innovative manufacturing going on out there in the world, but this SPICE product is particularly harmful. I mean, there was numerous cases this year of people really getting delusional from using this product far more than, you know, normal marijuana use. And so we passed a law locally, but since we can't pass as severe penalties as the state, we asked them to participate, and they did. They passed a law this year. The problem is you have to list the specific drugs that you're making illegal, and they're always finding little variations of these drugs that can kind of do the same thing. So this may be a law that has to be updated almost every year just to keep up with the chemistry. The other thing you've been hearing a lot about is, of course, we're making a very big effort this year on the homeless camps. And, you know, it's been something we've been working on to try and make sure we found the right legal fit in order to make sure that when you clear out a camp that you're not violating people's human rights. And we're sensitive to that, and the ACLU made sure we were very sensitive to it with repeated lawsuits that they eventually, the court gave us pretty clear guidance on what you have to do to make sure that, you know, yes, people aren't allowed to be on your public property past posted hours or to despoil public property, but they have rights as well. And somebody made the analogy that it'd be like arresting somebody in their apartment and leaving the door open and when you left, and so anybody could just go in and grab their stuff. So I don't know if that's a great analogy, because public space is a little bit different than your private apartment. But anyway, so what we're doing now is we have two options. We can give 15 days notice, post it, very clearly visible at every campsite, that this camp is going to be cleared out in 15 days. And with that 15-day notice, we do not have to store any of the personal items in there. That's enough notice that they can get their stuff and move it. Or we can give 3 days notice if we're willing to store their stuff. And as you might imagine, the stuff you find in camps, you really don't want to be storing. And now, you guys, you know, probably know some good warehouse space we could borrow, because this is building owners and managers. So if anybody's got an offer for us, bottom line is we're working with Salvation Army actually about being the agency that would handle the storage of items. And we actually do have a facility that would be ideal for it. But it's been kind of a slow process to get the agreement with Salvation Army finalized. Their lawyers are in California, and it's been a lot of back and forth. But so we posted the camps with a 15-day notice. That 15 days is up. And so you're going to see over the next few days a very aggressive campaign to take back our public spaces. And we look at it as a public safety issue. There's a lot of violence going on in the camps, not only amongst the residents, but to the residents. And you know, you should never be fearful about going into a public park or walking down a bike trail and wondering who's lurking in the bushes that, or what state they're in. So it's a public safety issue. We want to deal with it humanely, but at the same time, we're taking back our public spaces. It's going to be a no-tolerance summer, and we're not going to just settle for seeing them move to other places. We're going to be on it and stay on it. And again, these spaces belong to all of us, and we deserve to have the freedom to be unfearful when we're using those places. But the humane part is we go in with a SWAT team of service providers. You know, if somebody is just down on their luck economically, we can help them seek work. If they just need a temporary shelter while they get back on their feet, we can find them shelter. If they have mental health problems, we can get them with the right service providers. So we're gonna do it both public safety, but again, with a humane element to it. And the other thing, of course, is we've relaunched the Change for the Better program, which is a campaign to let the motorists know, don't lure panhandlers into the road with the offer of money. You're just not only endangering them, because oftentimes they are impaired, but you're just continuing the cycle of degradation that they're already in. All you're doing is buying them a drink. And I'm amazed how many people just don't quite get that concept that when you hand them money, you are not helping them. And there were some letters to the editor recently, including one from a priest that basically said, hey, it's the Christian thing to do. It's not the Christian thing to do to help these guys further destruct. The Christian thing to do is to get them real help. And the Change for the Better program says give money to Catholic Social Services or Salvation Army or any of the other agencies. If you really want to donate and really want to help, that's how you can help them. So we've actually been out doing warnings to motorists. So far we haven't written any tickets yet, because we wanted to make sure that we kind of eased into it. There's a little sticker shock when a motorist thinks they're doing the right thing and all of a sudden they're handed a ticket. But I think the warning period is over, and we're going to start being more aggressive about the ticketing part. And I think we've already seen instant results from this campaign. There are fewer panhandlers on the streets of Anchorage. In fact, a lot fewer. And the route that I come to work down Northern Lights and Benson, coming both ways, the regular habituates of the corners are not there. And so they're still around town. We haven't obviously solved the problem, but it's going to be part of the campaign this summer. The money that's given to the panhandler buys alcohol, and it ends up in those camps. It's a continuous cycle, and it's all related. And we're just it's time for a little Rudy Giuliani no tolerance policy on this stuff. So that's what we're doing. The other thing I want to talk just a little bit about, it. Obviously we had elections in April, and a couple things that are, as a result of the election, have created some change, both in law and, of course, we were successful with, again, road bonds always seem to do pretty well, about $30 million in bonds. Some of it matches legislative money, so it's going to be a very, very robust summer this year and next year for sure on road construction. I think there's about $70 million in road work going on this year, probably a similar or even greater amount next year. So we're really trying to focus on keeping our roads up. As we all know, it's a tough climate up here, and between that and studded tires, our roads take a beating. The one thing that we're still having a challenge with is residential roads, neighborhood roads. You know, those literally, you know, are built by the person that built the subdivision, and we're finding a lot of them in bad disrepair, needing work. But our traditional method has been to do road improvement districts, where the area votes on whether they want their road improved. And typically the city picks up 90% of the cost, the residents pick up the remaining 10%. It's spread over a 20-year period, so it's not a big hit. But we're finding just because of tough economic times, the residents don't want to vote to improve their own roads. But some of them are so bad that you know, you have to do something at some point. So we're trying to figure out a strategy on how to deal with neighborhood roads and finance it, because it's not cheap, obviously. So we're working on that. And then, of course, we had some public safety items on there. But there was an advisory vote on the alcohol ID. An ordinance came to the assembly which was going to apply the mandatory ID check to everything, restaurants, bars, and package stores. The advisory vote only said package stores, and so I think the assembly, in their wisdom, withdrew from the restaurant and bar part and went back to what the advisory vote suggested, and it passed like 70-some percent of the vote. And so the ordinance that passed is strictly package stores. You have to show your ID. The intent is that people who have restrictions on their license on buying alcohol will now, you know, won't be able to buy it at the package stores. But, you know, if you really look at it, do you think that's really going to stop people from getting alcohol? I don't think so. But, I mean, there's other forms of ID. There's passports. There's friends buying it for you. I don't think any law will really stop somebody if they really want alcohol. The other one, of course, and always controversial when we talk about parking, is the voters did approve. And Mr. Coffey and I worked on this when we were on the assembly, but together, and could not quite get the voters to agree, but this time around, I think, particularly when we talk about the value of public safety officers writing tickets downtown, essentially, you know, you got officers making $100,000 a year being meter maids. Well, I think the public realizes that's probably not the best use. The voters did approve changing back to where just in the downtown area alone, we can have folks who aren't sworn officers writing parking tickets, and they're going to focus just on parking violations. And if they have an expired tag or other violations, they're not allowed to give citations for that. So, and you know, the merchants downtown support it. They like turnover. They like to have customers have an opportunity to shop at their place. And if somebody's hogging a parking space all day, you don't get that turnover. So, I think it was a good bill. And now the goal is going to be that they don't get so, I guess, enforcement happy that that folks are just really scared to come downtown. If you're a minute late, you've got a ticket sitting on your car. And as we all know, the old parking authority was very efficient. And it's a little too efficient. I'm going to talk on one other thing, and that is I'm kind of jumping into the water here a little bit beyond what might typically be the mayor's role, and that is we're hosting an education summit in November, which is a result of several frustrations that I've had over the years. And I think when we went out to the public last fall with community dialogues about our city budget, what are the priorities, where should we cut, you know, how do we balance a budget when you know you've got deficits, and we heard over and over again from the public, well, what about the school district? Aren't you guys taking on that? And one of the frustrations is, I think people have seen over a decade, when I got on the assembly in 1999, the school district budget had just hit the $400 million mark. Now, 10 years later, with the same enrollment as 10 years ago, it's $820 million. So it's over doubled in 10 years. So Are the results doubled? Are we graduating, you know, at a high standard? No, we're just above average compared to the rest of the country. Well, I don't want to compare to the rest of the country. We're an international city. Our trade partners are Japan and Korea and China and Taiwan and Singapore. I want to benchmark against those countries. That's who our competition is. So our goal is really, are we the best school district in the nation? Well, probably not. Do we want to be? Well, of course you want to be. How do you get there? And I don't know the answer to these questions, and that's what the summit's all about. We're bringing in some of the top minds in the world who have reformed education in their country or in their district to tell us how they did it, what might work here. We're going to do a three-step process. We're going to have the summit in November with all of the brilliant minds we can attract. We're then in January, February timeframe going to take the ideas from the summit and go out to the community and have at least a half a dozen dialogues with large groups of people with an interest in education. And then we're going to reconvene the summit without the guest speakers, but with leadership in this town and state, and figure out a path forward. Is there legislative changes that need to be done, or things internally we can do ourselves? You know, what does the public really want to create a superior education system? And so it's a daunting task, but you look around the world, there's been places that have done this. They have said, we will not settle for being anything less than the best. And I always point to Finland as an example. They're number one in the world, have been for a decade. And, 42 years ago when I was graduating high school, America was number one in the world. I mean, it was just an accepted standard that we were the best educated nation in the world. We're 23rd now in the nation. And that's why I don't want to benchmark against the rest of the United States. You're benchmarking against an average education system. And we're at 23rd below average education system. So Finland decided about 20 years ago that they weren't strategically located, they didn't have great natural resources, and that their people were their best resource, and they changed the culture of an entire country. They said, we are going to be the best educated people on the face of the earth. We're going to put teachers at a status like lawyers and doctors. Well, doctors anyway, sorry, Dan. And they did it. You know, you can't teach in a Finnish school unless you're a master teacher. Only the best of the best teach at any grade level in Finland. And that's one of the strategies that we may have to adopt here, is working with our university system, training the best teachers, mentoring them, so that in every single classroom there's a master teacher. But I'm not trying to predict outcomes of the summit. I just, that's one thing that they did, and it clearly has worked. And so look forward this fall. The summit itself is not going to be an open to the public process. It's going to be 75 to 100 decision makers. Legislators, administrators, business owners that obviously are hiring people out of high school, private school owners, PTA representatives, just everybody that would have a hand in actually making change if we can come forward with recommendations that that make sense. So I'm going to stop there because I don't want to take, I know you guys want to hear about Title 21 and where Dan's at, but if you have any questions, I think I'll wait till Dan's presentation is over and then you can ask either of us a question. So thank you very much.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to a live recording of Mayor Dan Sullivan's State of the City Address, hosted by the Building Owners and Managers Association of Anchorage at the Hilton Anchorage on Friday, June 10th. Following the mayor, former Anchorage Assemblyman Dan Coffey provided an update on the rewrite of Anchorage's land use code, Title 21.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm nearing the end of my responsibilities under a contract that started last fall to basically review and discuss and work with the mayor on revisions to the provisionally adopted Title 21 code. And it's a 638-page document, so it's required a fair amount of time and a fair amount of energy going back and forth. I don't want to get into the particulars of it today because there's a lot of them, but I do want to talk to you about the process and what we're doing. And this comes from, you know, sort of a collaborative effort between the mayor and I on making sure he's making sure that I'm going down the paths that he likes us to go down. And secondly, talking to literally dozens and dozens of individuals and organizations that are active in land use issues throughout our community. I look around the room and I see people that I've met with over the time and talked to about all a whole host of different issues that are of concern to them. And a lot of the times those issues have been incorporated into our thinking, and some of the times they have not. People obviously who don't live and breathe land use, as I've done for 35 years as an attorney and then as an assemblyman and a planning and zoning commission member, you know, they've got their interests, but they're oftentimes limited. And so you try to qualify what they're seeking to do and move forward. I report to the mayor about what I call guiding principles or how I'm going forward, what's my reason for trying to address these issues and to maybe make amendments or changes or additions to it. And I'm struck by this. I have both the 1982 comprehensive plan that was adopted when Mayor Knowles was governor, and then the one that was adopted in 2001 when George Wirch was the mayor. And what strikes me is this one says, the title says Anchorage Comprehensive Development Plan, and this one says the Anchorage Bowl Comprehensive Plan. And I kind of wanted to be able to put development back into the language of the comprehensive plan and into Title 21. Another one of my litmus tests is cost and benefit. I believe it's really clear that we can determine costs when you put imposition on land use, because if you have a this requirement and a that requirement, you can quantify the amount of land, and we all know land is purchased and sold on the basis of per square foot. So getting a cost when you got to put 10% of your property or 5% of your property into snow storage and can't use it for any other purpose, it's pretty easy to say, well, you know, 5% of a acre lot is roughly, 22,000 square feet, commercial property at, say, $50 a square foot, that's a $10,000 imposition. You're in the ballpark, you get an idea. The problem with it is there's also some ancillary benefits on the other side of the cost, and they're much more difficult to quantify. And so it's a lot of times it's judgment calls. What are we costing and what are the benefits? So that's an ongoing way in which things are done. In terms, in my mind, when I was doing the work for the mayor. Then the process now is, I've been working on this since August. I would say from August to November, December wasn't a lot of work, you know, it's the holidays. And from August, September, October, and into the late, early winter, I met with a lot of people and a lot of entities and a lot of institutions, asking basically, what's your input? What do you think? What's the problem? From people like the home builders and the folks at BOMA and Cook Inlet Housing and others, I got very detailed critiques. And I've got files, I've got reams of paper, and you wade through it. And then you edit and amend and rewrite and consider, you go back to those folks and you say, well, wait a minute, what about? And you continue your dialogues and your discussions. I have a row of files that's probably that long that contains all the information that I've gathered over the time, and you end up reading things like what are the driveway standards that the municipality has. It's not in code, but it's referenced in the Title 21 and so on. So there's a wealth of reading and asking questions and trying to understand the consequences of many things that are proposed, were proposed, and whether or not those are appropriate or inappropriate for consideration. And that's virtually done. I will be done with my work in terms of the editing, the rewriting, and the recommendations to the mayor at the end of this month, at the end of June. I've already turned in 5 chapters with my analysis, and the mayor and I have, he may not know it yet because Betty just did it today, but we're scheduled to have some discussions on that in the next few weeks. And so we'll go through that all. The mayor has made it real clear to me and to anybody who's asked, either him or me, that it's going back to planning and zoning when we're done. And that should be, my timeline may be a little different than his. I think it should hit the Planning and Zoning Commission in July or early August. I think they should be able to be done with it in maybe a month. That's really their business, and we don't have any control over how long the commission takes to look at it. And then back to the assembly and into code, and we'll have discussions about effective dates, and we'll have discussions about whether the amendments are right, wrong, or we've missed something. I just happened to have a discussion today about the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System, which is now the Alaska Pollution Discharge Elimination System, and it's monitored by DEC, and it puts a ton of restrictions and requirements on stormwater and drainage. And there's a lot of history and a lot of associated with that, and that's a big driver as to how you develop your property. It's a huge driver. And it's really, it's something that we have very little control over, because it comes out of the federal system and is imposed on us. Okay, well, how do you address that in a Title 21 land use code? That's just an example of a very complex issue over which we have some influence, but we are not the ultimate arbiter of it. So when I'm done and the mayor is finished asking me questions about what I've done and fixing what he may consider to be my mistakes, and when he sends me off to medical school because he obviously doesn't think that a lawyer, anyway, then we'll go to the Planning and Zoning Commission, and then we'll get to the point where an effective date is established for this code. And since it will be such a far-reaching and important code, I would anticipate there'll be a fairly long lead time between the final adoption by the Assembly and the effective date. And just for example, one of the recommendations I'm making is, because there are substantial improvements in the new code over the old code, one of the things I'm recommending to the mayor would be that we allow people who want to operate under the new code, particularly in the residential and rental markets — we've heard a lot about that, and it's basically related to parking requirements — that they would have the opportunity to go ahead and proceed under the new code, while those who have plans in the works and want to operate under the old code would have a long enough period of time, so that you're not taking somebody who's spent a lot of money developing a plan and getting permits and getting ready to go, and then finding out that's all a waste of time, now you got to go under a new code. So we'll try to accommodate both of those considerations, where folks have an opportunity to take advantage of the new code, and those who are well down the road and need to continue under our existing code. I've been living this for many years. I started when Clarion came up here, and I was on the Planning and Zoning Commission and so on, and Clarion was the initial consultants we hired. And this legislation has been through multiple iterations over a period that started shortly after February of 2001. So we're coming up, it really didn't get to the administrative level until 02. I mean, the adoption of code until 02. It took a time after the adoption of this code to start working on the amendments to Title 21. But basically, I have been engaged in that process since its inception. It's a very educational process, and you learn a lot more than you knew before. But the danger that exists in any regulatory scheme is that all of the interest and all of the concerns of the community, both economic, aesthetic, quality of life, all the things that make Anchorage a unique place, have to be blended in a way that keeps the economic engines of our town running, and at the same time recognizes what makes it such a unique and wonderful place. And it's hard to balance, and it's sometimes difficult to understand the benefits that don't have some direct economic consequences or benefit to the community. But it's a worthwhile effort to try to keep those things in mind, because, in fact, people live here because of many of those things. And what I'm hopeful for is that I've achieved a little better balance than what I thought was found in the provisionally adopted code. And I come from a private sector, commercial property owner perspective. But I also have lived here for 64 years. It'll be 65 years in a month. And I like this town. You know, I've made a wonderful living. I've raised my families and so on. So for me, it's important to recognize the economics. It's also important to recognize the beautiful scenery we have, the creeks, the streams, the open spaces. We've got parks like you wouldn't believe. Nobody in the whole country has stuff like we have up here that just adds to the quality of life. Kincaid Park, Bicentennial Park, Flat Top, on and on and on it goes. How do you meld all those into a land use code, which is probably equal to the building code as being the most important code that we have in Anchorage? My goal all along has been to keep this in mind and read it and try to follow the adopted provisions, of which there are 97, folks. These are strategies and goals in this little book. 97 seems like an awful lot to do, but I've attempted to do that, and in order to get context, I read the 1982 code more than once again. If I can give to the mayor something that has achieved that goal of bringing all these disparate interests together in a way that preserves the economic and other interests of this community, then I will have succeeded in my work, and I can go about my other business without working Saturdays and Sundays to get this thing done, which is what I've been doing lately. So I'm here to answer any questions you have about process, procedure, and we'll all get a chance to do a lot of examination of the specifics when it gets, when the mayor and I are finished with our review and it gets put over to the Planning and Zoning Commission. Thank you all.
Thank you both. I think we have a few minutes for questions, if you guys are okay. Anyone have any questions for either one of our speakers? Really?
Run.
Wow.
Pass it.
Okay. Well, thank you both, Mayor Sullivan and Dan Coffey, for coming to take a little time and educate us and give us an update. We really appreciate it.
This is KESKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to former Anchorage Assembly member Dan Coffey's update on Title 21. Before that, you heard Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan on the state of the city. The Building Owners and Managers Association, also known as BOMA Anchorage, hosted the mayor and Mr. Coffey at a luncheon at the Anchorage Hilton on Friday, June 10th, 2011. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our new website, alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.